you. Okay, we've been told by an important looking man that it's time to start. So we've been better had. I'm John Sparks. I'm Chief Executive of Crisis, the National Homelessness Organisation, and I'll be co-chairing this session with...
I'm Phil Payden from Expert by Experience.
So, just in case, just to check you're in the right room, so this is a session on involving people with lived experience in transforming services. So if you're not here for that, now's the time to go. If you are here for that, good. We've got some fascinating speeches ahead of us. Just a few comments from me at the beginning. Actually, not from the homelessness world. In a previous life, I used to run a charity called Scope, a disability charity. So the whole language of user engagement was incredibly important to us there. We went through an entire transformation, not only of the services of the organisation, but the entire organisation and what it delivered, using the vehicle of co-production. And in the process, we became one of the biggest employers of disabled people in the country, in that one of the things that was clearly missing for us was the numbers of people who would or could use our services that were employed by us. And over the 4 years that I ran the charity, we grew to employing some 650 disabled people. So we got to the point where there was never a meeting happened where there wasn't someone in the room who could actually have been one of our services. This is a subject which is very dear to my heart. And coming into the homelessness world, equally, if not more important, that we're in the business of enabling, supporting, empowering, whatever the language is of your sector, people to get the tools they need to turn their lives around, and who better to help them get the tools they need and even tell us what the tools are than people who've been through that themselves. So this is a really important subject to me. But I'm not one of the speakers, I'm supposed to be just chairing. So we've got great speakers. We've got Alison from National Survivor and User Network. We've got Kate from Groundswell and Susie Finlayson from the Young Foundation. Ahead, Alison's going to start. The format will be about 15 minutes for each presentation for the first 30 minutes. Then I think Phil is going to make some observations about what we've heard from the presenters, and then we'll open to questions after that. Alison.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, my name is Alison Faulkner, and I have my own experience of mental health problems, and I also work as a researcher and consultant generally in the mental health sort of field. A lot of the work over the last few years that I've been doing has been with NSUN, which is the logo in the bottom corner there, the National Survivor User Network. And I'm going to say a bit more about NSUN in a moment. But essentially what the work has been about is about involvement and engagement and co-production and just talking to John earlier, just thinking about how the language does vary across the different sectors. Co-production has become a much more sort of, I guess, a bit more popular word recently. We've stuck with involvement. We started about sort of five, six years ago with some funding from the Department of Health for our partnership work. So what NSUN is, it's a national network across England which tries to sort of build capacity amongst survivors, service users and user groups, and basically provide the tools for people to influence services and policy and practice locally. We are a tiny charity with an enormous sort of ambition, I think. And we were, as I say, lucky to get money from the Department of Health to carry out this particular work, which has given us the opportunity not just to develop a framework for involvement, but also to test it out in a few different areas to see how that framework works in practice. So what our vision is of a future where there is nothing about us without us, a phrase that comes from the disability movement originally, so where involvement is meaningful in all aspects of our lives, can be useful in building resilience and changing people's lives, where there is genuine partnership working between mental health services, professionals, service users, carers, based on agreed and shared outcomes, and where this partnership works towards common goals of respect, recovery, choice, and control, for everybody. Now, our framework was built within the mental health context, but there is no question that it has relevance for other user and carer involvement exercises, practices, and across the different sectors. So we would, the first question is to say why involvement, and why would we want it? I hope that question is no longer relevant, really, because I think that most organisations, particularly as I've been listening to you to this conference today, clearly this sector is it's very well embedded, the idea of experts by experience having the knowledge and the expertise to share with professionals and services and to say, this is how we need things to be different. And I think it's really vital in these areas, particularly where services have traditionally failed people, that we do hear from people directly. And I think that's also true in the mental health sector, where services are sometimes questionably helpful to people. Particularly I'm thinking in that sense that the mental health system has the capacity, has the ability to coerce people to treatment, and that is a fundamental underlying problem with mental health services overall. So with meaningful involvement, we're talking about the prospect. It is potentially possible, and in our main report, and I can put the website address on the flip chart, we did a lot of research to sort of look at what are the benefits of involvement, and there is some evidence that involvement improves lives and experiences of people experiencing and using services. That it's possible that we reach the experience of the person who's in need of support today, tomorrow, or next week, and that the benefits for all concerned include not just individuals and communities, but also staff, services, and organisations. Services can be providing a better service for people, but also, I think, it's also possible, if it's done well, that staff get the benefit as well, that the experience for staff is improved. Because people want to be giving a good service, and getting that feedback sort of link, that feedback loop back from people, and hearing that actually the service is getting better is, it makes everybody's lives, I think, really just so much better. That's the partnership. I won't spend time telling you about them today. So what we did to form this framework, and that is the framework, I've got a few summary reports here on the table. If anybody would like to take some. I don't think I've got enough for everybody. This is the framework. It's basically five standards of principles, purpose, presence, process, and impact. I always tell the story of how we started out with three P's and an I, so PPPI, and how that was, confusing, because so many people are talking about PPI, and then and then you start thinking about whether it's to do with getting money from insurance. Anyway, but during the course of our work, and you'll see there, we if you can read that one all right, yes, come through a period of consultation and testing, we added another P, which was the principles. And actually, the funny thing was, I don't know why it wasn't there in the first place, because it turns out to be really one of the most important. It's actually quite difficult to get right, but it's also one of the most important. It's quite hard to tell people how to do it. How do you go about, sitting down and talking about sharing your principles? What are your principles? What are principles, values, principles? But it is, I think, one of the most important, and I've heard that from some of you today as well, talking about respect, the importance, for example, of respect, which I think is fundamental. So we built our framework from previous work that we've done for the Department of Health and for those other acronyms that are no longer with us. We did two quite considerable literature reviews, one about involvement in general, and that's where some of the evidence we found about what the benefits of involvement are. But also another literature review, which I carried out, of the vast array of tools and guidelines that there are out there on involvement and engagement and everything, to try and sort of draw what was the essence out of all of those. And I think that's what I think we've offered that is new and different, if you like, in this framework, was to sort of bring some of that learning together. I've just listed a few of the reports there which also came out of our work, and I won't go into those in too much detail right now. We also went to some pilot sites. We had three pilot sites in England, in which we tested out the framework and we ran service user leadership programs, training programs. And I will come and say a little bit more about that later on. So principles, how do we treat each other? How do we want to be treated? They're the kind of rules or beliefs that influence the way that we behave and the way that we treat other people. The purpose, why are we involving people? Why are we becoming involved? It's just a simple question that many people don't get right at the beginning of an involvement exercise. You know, why are you doing it? You've got to have an idea of why you're doing it. There's no point doing it just for its own sake because it will become a tokenistic exercise. Presence, who is involved? Are the right people involved in the right places? If your service is quite frequently used by black and minority ethnic communities and you're not actually having those people at the table to talk about what you're doing, then you're not doing it right. So early on in the process is looking at who needs to be there, who, what kind of people are going to be useful in this particular activity. And the process, how are people involved, how do people feel about the involvement process? That is the area, I think, that in many ways is the biggest, and all the tools and guidelines that I did research on are very much focused on the process, the how to do it. There are quite a few documents out there about some of the sort of practical issues. And then finally, impact. What difference does involvement make? That relates back to purpose, because you have to have an idea of why you're doing it in order to be able to monitor whether you've achieved it or not. Have we made a difference? Have we made a difference to this activity that we're doing here and maybe to the organisation more broadly? Now, I can go in quite a lot of detail under each of these, but I don't think there will be any need for me to do that because it would take quite a long time. And as I say, if anybody wants sort of to read a bit more about it, this is the summary report. And on our website, everything is freely available on our website, all the reports listed in the slides. And there's also a main report, which is about 50 pages long, I guess. And that brings together all of the sort of learning that we went through during the process of producing the framework, and also some of the sort of themes and issues that arose from doing it. I can obviously, if anybody asks questions later, we can go on a bit more about each of these. But so there's principles, and then there's purpose. I'll just say a little bit about that. So it's important to share that purpose throughout an organisation. If you're doing a piece of involvement work that is actually quite small and local within a large organisation, it's really important to communicate what you're doing and why you're doing it to the wider organisation. We've got lots of examples of where involvement has failed because other people don't appreciate why service users, patients, clients are being brought in and taking, are they doing my job? You know, staff might feel really threatened by this. So a communication, a clarity and transparency principle there is important in terms of sharing that purpose and that goal. I talked a little bit about presence. So we divided process into issues like engagement, communication, support and training, and practical issues. And it really so depends on the nature of the involvement that you're doing. It does, I mean, a lot of the work that I do is about research. So I work to be involved in research myself, but also to involve other people, service users, survivors, in research programs, research projects. Well, in that case, support and training come in really sort of quite significantly because the training, perhaps in research skills and in the topic that you're researching, is a vital part of that process to skill people just sufficiently that they can contribute in a confident way to the process. And I mentioned the leadership training that NSUN has carried out, and that's a really useful, valuable kind of training program. And I've not run it myself, but I've seen the results of it and videos of people talking about how powerful it was. And that's a really, really powerful way of engaging people, enabling people to have the skills to speak, just to speak about their experiences in a different way, to be able to sort of sit at the table and to contribute in a confident way. It's building up confidence and self-esteem and self-value, realising you've actually got something to contribute in these kinds of processes. So There's questions about impact. I mean, monitoring involvement is a difficult one. We've got some resources on our website that help you with each of these headings. And monitoring is an important question. It's not just about what's the output, it's also about ensuring the process is a good one. People won't wish to become involved again or won't stay involved if the process itself isn't a good experience for people. And that often involves building into the process something like peer support, opportunities for people to meet together and talk to each other and support each other through it, as well as what I mentioned before, support and training and things that make enable people to feel valued in that process. We very much favour thinking of involvement in terms of a cycle of learning and influence. So doing a little bit of involvement, finding out what worked, watching, listening, thinking, discussing, changing your ideas, making, and then starting, going around the cycle again. I think people are often scared of failing with involvement. Oh, I've got to get it right, and people won't like me. I won't do it quite right. And I think we just think it's so important to just try, see what happens, and then come around to try something new or try something a bit differently. I think at the moment I'm working with a trust in Lincolnshire, and we're actually literally just about to start. You know, we're just going to have our first workshop in the middle of March. And then we'll have another workshop about a month later. We'll have time in between those two workshops to think about whether we've got enough people involved so far and what else we need to do to change. And it's a testing. It's for me, it's a learning experience too, to see what we can do to make our process better to support the next people who wish to, you know, who are interested. These are some of the overarching themes that came out of our process of working towards the framework. And I don't suppose they're unfamiliar themes to you. I mean, we obviously discovered barriers and challenges to involvement. We felt that the power imbalance was something that still needs thinking about very often. And that can vary according to context. So we often sometimes work with psychiatrists, and that can be quite a significant power difference if you have just recently been to an appointment with your psychiatrist and then you're getting involved in a service and you're very conscious of that power relationship in that situation. So I think there's some things that people need support through those processes. One of the things that I didn't raise early on perhaps was that one of the themes that NSUN's been very committed to is ensuring that we work with and in partnership with black and minority ethnic communities and organisations, and we have done that to some extent. We always feel we can improve on that, but we have tried to bring that theme, that thread, through all of this work and this framework. Anyway, so I think I'm nearly at the end. What next steps? What does implementation look like? We are inviting organisations to sign up. This is partly to help us, hopefully in the future. At the moment, NSUN looks like two people and a dog, except there wasn't even a dog. But the funding at the end of this financial year has gone right down. So for next year, it's going to be quite difficult. But we're making all of our online resources free. Well, silly us. We should have been charging for them, shouldn't we? But we're working towards, at the moment, another piece of work that I've been doing is indicators, looking at what those indicators might be for each of those headings. And that's quite hard, but it's part of the process of working with the trust that I mentioned earlier, so working with individual organisations. But next steps, what we hope to do is to make that signing up mean something more exciting, so that when organisations sign up with us, what we'll be able to do is offer workshops, offer training, offer resources to people who sign up with us, and that's going to be a future project, because it isn't actually happening at the moment. But as I say, we are still able to offer support if people wish to pay for it. So that's absolutely
fantastic. So thank you very much. That's the end of my presentation.
Great, thank you. We'll go straight through to Kate and Susie from Groundswell and the Young Foundation talking about peer advocacy, and then we'll move on to some questions and answers after that. I'm hoping.
Your name's on it.
What I can't see is the mouse. Oh, there's the mouse. Could you see it?
It's a seamless operation.
Sorry. Here we go. Here we go. Whoa.
Clever system of the presentations having the name of the speaker on it.
Yay! I recognise that presentation.
Yeah, I've seen
that
before.
Yeah, right, here we go. Slideshow. From the beginning. Yay!
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, we could go on for this. My name's Kate, and I'm the Director of Advocacy at Groundswell, which is a very posh title for a job which is basically I oversee the Groundswell Homeless Help Peer Advocacy Programme. And I'm very briefly going to tell you a little bit about the Homeless Help Peer Advocacy Service before handing over to Susie, who will tell you about her evaluation of the service. Just to tell you a little bit about the history of Groundswell, because I think it's actually important in understanding how who we are and how we work. We started 20 years ago, and it was started by somebody working in a homelessness service and a service user. And it was started by them because there was a frustration about homelessness services not working, and they're feeling that they were not working because they were not designed by people who've got lived experience of homelessness. So the whole idea with Groundswell was to bring together people with a variety of experiences of homelessness to talk about what the solutions were. And as an organisation, we did things called speak outs, where we got lots of people together, where we got policy people, we got homeless people, and everybody talked to each other. Then we became a little bit more finessed and did something called the Homeless People's Commission, where we used a more finessed model to try and get policymakers in the room and present them with evidence. We did a lot of stuff around peer research, and out of that came the fact that we saw that a lot of issues that people were facing were around health, and that health was very low on the agenda for homelessness projects. So housing, benefits, substance misuse was all quite high, but physical health was quite low. Whereas actually when we were talking to homeless people themselves, they were reporting back that health was a big issue. So we decided we wanted to try and design a programme that helped to tackle that. The other thing I should have said actually at the outset was that Groundswell still today very much has an ethos of involvement. The majority of staff at Groundswell have got lived experience of homelessness. All our volunteers have got lived experience of homelessness. So as an organisation, we're very much weighted towards that. So anyway, going back to our research, we found that people were not accessing healthcare, and that the reasons around that were chaotic lifestyles. So if they've got a letter saying you need to go for a colonoscopy in 3 weeks' time, obviously 3 weeks' time they completely forgotten about that. Practical things, people didn't have money to travel, didn't have the ability to get themselves to hospitals, and actually low confidence. A low confidence that they would be treated well by services, that they'd be welcomed. We heard a lot of people talking about the problem of getting past receptionists, so bad past experiences. Also low confidence that if they went in and talked to a GP, talked to a consultant, that they would be able to put their side forward. And when we talked to people about what would help, they said, somebody who understood going with me. And out of that, Homeless Health Peer Advocacy was born, and it's a beautifully simple model. It's such a simple model, you can describe it to a cab driver, to a hairdresser, and they don't glaze over, they actually understand what you're speaking about. It's great, it's the only job I've ever had that that my grandma understands. And we train up peer advocates, which Phil has just started his training, he's on week three of his training. Yeah. We train up peer advocates, they go through 6 weeks of training, so 3 days a week for 6 weeks, and they then support people one-to-one to access healthcare. Do you want to just... And That sounds quite simple. There's a lot of different steps. So they work with people to help them get to their health appointments, help them make sure that their health appointments are booked at a time that works for them. So maybe early morning's better, maybe later in the day is better. So we do quite a lot of rebooking of appointments. We go and pick people up. We travel with them. We pay for their travel. We talk to them about what they want to get out of the appointments and what questions do they want to ask, what are they worried about. We will help them find where their appointment is. I mean, all of us will have at some point been in a hospital. It's a nightmare trying to find out the department that you need to go to. Our advocates will help them to do that. They will help them get past security. They will help them negotiate with the receptionist. They will sit and wait with them. Actually, that's a big part of what we do, just sitting and waiting for somebody and making sure that they stay is really big. If they want us to, we will go into the appointment with them and make sure that they understand what they're being told, ask consultants to re-explain things in more simple language, make sure that they understand what their options are, sometimes actually advocate for them if they feel that they're not being listened to. And then we will take them through coffee, cake afterwards, help them process what's just happened, take them back to the hospital, to the day centre, and if they want us to, we'll then also help them talk to key workers, support workers about what's happened. So one-to-one support to get people to appointments sounds quite simple. Actually, there's a lot of different stages within that. Let's move on to the next one. We started off in 2010 running this project in Westminster. We're funded from the NHS Regional Innovation Fund. And because it worked, it's grown. We're now commissioned in 8 different London boroughs, and we're primarily funded directly by CCGs. We get some money from trusts and foundations, some from local authorities, but primarily by CCGs. So it's grown, and it's a really successful programme. We were really proud of it, and we felt it was really working. But we also felt that there's no point in us saying that it's really working, we're really proud of it. We really needed to get an external evaluator in to look to see if it was, and that's where Susie came in.
Perfect. Segue into me. So, hi, I'm Susie Finlayson from the Young Foundation. And as Kate was saying, they got some funding from Oak Foundation for us to come in and independently evaluate the Homeless Health Peer Advocacy Programme. And so we've pulled through the programme, we've pulled on a lot of different data sources. I think, as was highlighted nicely in the talk before, actually linked data is not currently that easily available for these kinds of things. So we have had to get data from where we can, and we've complemented that a lot with some semi-structured interviews which we conducted with current and former peer advocates. And I think in keeping with the kind of involvement, the whole ethos of Groundswell, we trained up some peer researchers who went out and interviewed current clients as well, which I think both supported those individuals as peer researchers, but also got us a lot more kind of rich information from clients than probably I would have got walking in wearing my blazer and things. So those were the data sources we had. And in terms of sorting out our evaluation framework, we conducted some interviews with kind of key stakeholders, we talked to peer advocates about what they thought the impact of the programme was, and then there was also an advisory board in place to help us with that. And for the evaluation framework, we wanted to try and really assess kind of, was Groundswell meeting its aims? Is the HHPA programme meeting its aims around getting people experiencing homelessness to make and attend their health appointments, which ultimately would improve their health? Within that, we started to explore how we might be able to assess those things. So we were looking at things like understanding the barriers to accessing healthcare in a little bit more detail so that we could get that contextualisation in there. And looking at if HHPA decreases the reliance on kind of secondary unplanned care. As we all know, people experiencing homelessness use a disproportionately high amount of kind of A&E services and things. And whether it reduces the level of missed kind of scheduled outpatient appointments. I mean, the level of DNA amongst the, so did not attend amongst the homeless population is higher than the general population. And if people aren't going to their health appointments that are made for them, their health is less likely to improve. We wanted to have a look at whether that made any cost savings for service providers. if those impacts were there. And then additionally, and this was outside what we'd originally talked about, but I think is really kind of relevant to the discussion in the room, what the impact actually was for the peer advocates. So we set out initially just to say, what is the health impact of this programme? And it quickly became very relevant, kind of apparent there was a lot more happening. So we put that in as well. And I think kind of interest to us particularly, because we're not homelessness experts, was that there's a huge kind of strides have been made in the provision of service. So there are kind of specialist GP services, there is outreach into hostels, but a lot of those barriers to accessing those services still remain. So there's kind of the service supply side has come a lot closer, but actually there's still that hurdle to get over for a lot of people. So the key findings of the programme, the evaluation effectively are that the HHPA programme does support people experiencing homelessness to have improved health. So we found that it works effectively to meet its aims, because it increases attendance at scheduled outpatient appointments, it decreases reliance on secondary and unplanned care, but it also increases the knowledge and confidence and motivation to both kind of go and seek health services, but also to more proactively manage health. And we found that through both the kind of numerical data, but also through the kind of rich qualitative information that came out from the peer research interviews. And I particularly kind of think that the quote up on the top left kind of explained quite easily what a lot of people were saying to us, that basically without the support of Groundswell to get someone to an appointment, they genuinely believe that they would have died by now. And I think that kind of encapsulates the importance of the programme. So we've been working on the evaluation for a year, and we looked back at a year's worth of kind of Groundswell HHPA supported appointments. So during that year, Groundswell, the peer advocates had supported 285 clients to over 1,000 health appointments successfully, which is quite a sizable amount of appointments to go to. And we also had a little look at the cost implications, as I mentioned. So I just wanted to go into a little bit more detail on the reduction in DNA, so the missed appointments rates. So through various data sources, we've found out that there's 12% at Guy's and St Thomas's and King's NHS NHS Foundation Trust. There's 12% amongst the general population, so those who aren't homeless, 12% of scheduled outpatient appointments are missed. When we looked at the homeless population without any Groundswell support, that went up to 34%. We then looked at the rates when there was a peer advocate with someone going to an appointment with you, supporting someone to an appointment, and that brought it down to 15%, which is a 68% reduction, but also, from my perspective, I think actually that just the fact that it comes down almost in line with the general population is probably one of the kind of most dramatic things there. When we looked at how much DNA missed appointments cost to the NHS, across Guy's and Tommy's, and then we did some calculations based on this level of reduction in missed appointments, there could be a kind of up to £60,000 potential reduction in the cost of missed appointments. And obviously if people are going to their scheduled health appointments, the assumption is their health would begin to improve. And then in a bit more detail as well on the reduced reliance on secondary and unplanned care. So we found that in the 6 months following initial peer advocate support for a group of known clients of Groundswell, there was a 42% reduction in secondary care use when compared with the 6 months prior to having a peer advocate support. And that worked out using actual cost data, an £870 reduction over a year per client. So when we did some sums on that turned out kind of for £1 spent, there's a potential reduction of £2.43 purely in unplanned secondary care. So that doesn't include the DNA, it doesn't include ongoing potential savings into the future associated with improved health and then possible reduction in reliance on healthcare services as health management improves. And what we couldn't see in the data was a similarly linked increase in primary care access. So we'd made an assumption at the beginning that as the secondary care, unplanned care would come down, people would access more primary care. But the data that we had available to us, we couldn't link to every primary care instance because we weren't able to link the data, which I think was really clear to me before. There's stuff coming out of the qualitative interviews of people just saying, you know, I never go to, unless I go to the A&E. You know, I've had 9 ambulances in the last year and now I've not had an ambulance for over 6 months. Which I think is just, it was really striking out of the qualitative information. And then on what I think often, so the King's Fund, who does a lot of the thinking on these health things, calls patient activation, but is effectively people's knowledge, confidence, their motivation and skill to manage and engage with their health and healthcare management. And throughout all of the interviews, this came out as something that people genuinely just felt better able to engage with their health, that they would now go to the doctor, they would go to the pharmacy and pick up their prescriptions and things like that. So that suggests that future health will also be improved. Just quickly on this, we're out of time. So one of the things that HHPA aims to do is to increase the independence of people experiencing homelessness to access their own healthcare services by helping them to increase this confidence motivation. What we found was that it probably wasn't as marked increase in independence as we might have assumed at the beginning. And there are probably a number of factors of this. Partly, as you're all aware, the kind of multiple and complex barriers that people are facing mean that that's a really slow process. You're not going to take someone to two appointments and then suddenly they'll be making all their appointments themselves, going off and doing anything, because that would be miraculous, and I think you guys would have all of the money in the world. So it is a long, slow process in that people make little strides that aren't identified through independent access. So they will start to meet people on the way to an appointment, at an appointment, or they'll start to say, I'm going to go to the pharmacy and the GP on my own, but actually when I go to an outpatient appointment at hospital, I need someone to come with me, because that's just a further barrier. And actually that many of those barriers to access remain. So you could be as confident and as independent and able to access your healthcare, but if you can't afford to get to the hospital, you can't get to your appointment. And the other thing was understanding that there are different needs amongst the group of clients that you work with. Those with long-term conditions, it may not be appropriate. Those with physical disabilities, it may not be appropriate or possible for them to independently access it. And for those in end-of-life care, again, it's not appropriate for them to be moving towards independent healthcare access. Actually, there's a kind of different purpose in that space. And I think what's really kind of clear and why it's important in this room to say it is what came through really strongly was actually the role of the peer is what makes this work. That ability to share that experience, to build the trust and the rapport really easily and kind of quickly and build those relationships and to feel like you weren't being judged and that somebody understood why you might be a bit chaotic at times and they weren't judging you for that and they could support you get past the receptionist because they understand and they get it. And the other thing we found about the peer experience, which was really interesting, was the advocates were seen as being outside of the system. So people experiencing homelessness have been through loads and loads of systems, the criminal justice system, benefit system, and actually having somebody who's seen as totally outside of that seemed really beneficial to people. They could develop that trust and rapport, and it wasn't just seen like another service that was kind of being done to somebody and that you had to go along with it or something would be sanctioned. Actually, it was just something here for people. So that's kind of the end. And I think just from my perspective, I think it's that actually drawing on the importance and the impact of people like yourself, Phil, with the kind of experts by experience to actually help people to overcome some of those barriers just really clearly came through from the evaluation. Thank you.
I have one final thing, sir, which is we are at the moment, because we feel we have a very successful model, we are exploring the possibilities of social franchising to look at how we could roll it out in other areas. And if there are any organisations out there who think this sounds really good, we'd like to set up something like this in our organisation, we'd be interested in hearing from you, because we are looking at partners to pilot that point.
So. And the only other thing on that is the report of this will be launched on the 23rd of March.
Yes.
So we will be, you'll be able to access it after that.
It will be on our website.
Yes. Thank you.
So just before we go to questions and answers, Phil was going to reflect on what we've heard so far.
Hello there. I'm Phil, expert by experience. And as Kate said, I've just started Groundswell, and it's a brilliant organisation. 3 weeks ago, I was lost, didn't know what I was doing with myself. Since I've started Groundswell, I feel like I've got a future. You know, and it really is. It's not just the people you go out to help, but it also helps the peer advocate. Kate, you said about there's 8 boroughs, and I know you do 1 borough drug and alcohol, is it? Is there plans to branch out more boroughs and other different services?
Yeah, we'd love to be able to, well, in an ideal world, we'd love to be able to do mental health, physical health, and drug and alcohol work, because we see the three as being very, very interrelated. So we'd love to be able to do that everywhere we worked. I should have said, actually, I don't think we ever did say at any point, what we do primarily is support people around physical healthcare. Unfortunately, drug and alcohol stuff work is funded completely separately to physical health stuff. So drug and alcohol work tends to be funded by public, by the local authority, by public health. Physical health stuff is funded by the CCG, by the NHS. And trying to get both those pots of money has proved impossible, apart from in Hammersmith and Fulham, where we've got both bits of money, they work together really well, and it's brilliant. So if there are any commissioners out there who would like to help us get the drug and alcohol money as well. Mental health, the reason we've not gone out into mental health is because we want to get some money to pilot that and to develop that slowly, because we think it might work a little bit differently. So we're going for a couple of funding bids at the moment to get some trust and foundation money in to properly explore that and pilot it to make sure we do it properly, because I think it will work a little bit differently. But in the ideal world, yes, we do all.
That's all for me.
Okay. Right, questions from the floor. Alison, do you want to... That's sort of tight fit up here, but... any questions, observations from the floor? Yes, at the back.
Hi. Really fantastic programme. I'm really interested in kind of the progression of pathways to clients, hearing how they can be more dependent on use of the time. So I'm wondering about what are the progression pathways for the care advocates? You know, is there opportunity for them to educate on the service
Very definitely. We've got a volunteer progression programme, so we actually have a paid volunteer progression worker full-time who works with peer advocates. So there's a kind of split. They have line managers who support them with their work as peer advocates, and then the volunteer progression manager uses coaching methodology to support them with how they're moving on. Typically, people come to us at a point where they're still living in a hostel, but they're just moving on, and quite often during the time they're with us, they'll be moving into a flat, they'll be becoming more independent. So we do give a bit of wraparound support around that. We do open up roles within the organisation wherever we can. So Jerry, who you all saw speak today, is a paid caseworker with us. So wherever we can open that up, we do. But we also have very good relationships with lots of other homelessness agencies, and we'll support people on into jobs within the homeless sector. So I don't know if any of you met Stacey, who's also here as an expert by experience. She's a peer advocate with us. And actually started an apprenticeship with St Mungo's yesterday. So we're seeing lots of peer advocates moving on into homelessness. We'd like to see more moving on into health. Oz, who was on the stage today, is also one of our ex-peer advocates and has moved on to work in West Middlesex Hospital. And Sonia, who was also around, I think, on the van, is just she's doing an access course and is hopefully going on to do a nursing degree next year. We are finding NHS work is more difficult for people because there is very kind of draconian blanket bans around people with criminal records, even if they're not particularly worrying criminal records. And it's very difficult to get work. We've got a lot of people who would like to go into nursing in particular, and it's very difficult if you've got any kind of past record, even if that's quite a long way in the past.
I would look into that more, or maybe there's ways around it, because I am a peer support worker with the NHS. I have a criminal record.
We really do. We've had a couple of people who've been turned down recently, and it's quite devastating.
Okay.
So I think it depends on the trust.
What area you're going into,
yeah,
and what the record is. It's not a blanket.
Yeah, I think HR in hospitals tends to be more risk adverse than HR in charities, for instance.
I work in NHS.
But yeah, it would be good to see the NHS taking a less risk adverse, so that they could get more people with that kind of lived experience in, because we'd love to see more people going into nursing, going into training to be doctors, becoming brain surgeons.
Okay.
There you go, Phil.
Yeah,
I was just going to say something about Enson, really. I mean, I've done a few bits and pieces with Enson. And, you know, the thing about the power of balance, when you mentioned that, it kind of, it just reminded me of this interview panel I went on, and I got there and found that it was my old psychiatrist on the interview panel, and I found that mega weird until I rolled the eyes, because he hasn't aged. My mum fancied him. He's still fancied him. He's got like three good hairs. But once that eyes was broken, you know, it worked fine. We had a discussion afterwards about pros and cons of diagnosis and adolescence, and a bit about my experience and how he didn't help although he was trying to. And actually, you know, I just think with 4PI, it addresses that quite well. You know, and the whole thing flaws, I think, AMH bit is as important as another. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, about that, just because as soon as you said that, I thought, you know what?
Yeah.
Just reminded us of that so much. And it's just, people don't recognise the importance of going in there, being on a level playing field with everyone. You know, going to a meeting, I remember being in a meeting with another expert by experience, and we disagreed on a certain thing. And, well, honestly, I mean, the room, you could have dropped a pin. They must have thought, oh my God, the crazy people are going to kick off. Disagreed on something. You know, we were there, we were adults and controlled ourselves really well. Well, I think, well, I'm surprised no one fell off the seat. Like, we've got mental health issues, we're not aliens, you know, we're not completely innocent. You know, and I think, you know,
I mean, the stigma and, you know, discrimination are all of these, in all of our sectors. And I think in mental health, there's often expectation that you're going to be unpredictable, that you're going to not make sense or something.
Well, I never make sense, but, you know, I can kind of pretend that I know.
Yeah. No, I went to a seminar once and, you know, I mean, I present myself really well, I think, in quite middle-class accent and stuff like that, but there was a psychiatrist in the audience who had once admitted me to hospital, and it was just like, I wanted the ground to open up, I wanted to get out of there, you know, but it went fine. Like you said, we actually met in the toilet later and said hello, and, you know, and she was really fantastic, actually. She said it's really important that you are there to sort of talk about what this is like, you know. So.
Yeah. How many members of staff in Ansel have had mental health problems?
I think all of them. I mean, it's an entirely user-led organisation, so, and all of the trustees have got some lived experience, and maybe one person who's got, look, I'm not so sure, but I think it's all.
Okay, hello.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Susie, if you saw how that pathway of people moving on in the Groundswell program, how that impacted them.
Yeah, so there actually are a few examples of clients who then became peer advocates, but probably not quite as many as you'd like, I would have thought.
It can be a slower process, so
yeah.
We're looking at developing, because peer advocacy, as Phil, I'm sure, is quite a full-on thing. It's, you know, you do the six-week training, it's 3 days a week. So we're looking at how we can develop roles which are slightly less of a commitment, so that people can kind of, can go in easier level.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that kind of came through in the interviews is people saying, you know, now I've got this sorted, I want to go on and do this. They're kind of starting to address underlying health issues rather than at the point of them kind of reaching a bit of a critical need. So that kind of progress and getting lives in order, and there were certainly a few people through the peer research interviews who talked about now wanting to kind of address alcohol and drug issues as well. So it's kind of that element, and I think that, just as we said, it is a really slow process, but actually kind of managing a health issue can help to open those doors up. And the other thing that the peer advocates do is offer a really kind of positive role model as somebody who's definitely been there, kind of they've had all of that shared experience, but they're now in this position where, you know, they can manage their health, they're moving towards a more stable life, they've possibly got into a flat now, and just seeing actually this guy, a year ago he was where I am now, actually kind of opens that kind of possibility up to people. Definitely came through in the interviews.
We find that a lot as well, actually.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the sort of work that we do, it's if you see someone else who is able to sort of do something, and it presents that sort of role model and an opportunity, you know, maybe to see yourself differently, be opened up.
This gentleman here, and then at the front here.
Presumably you have some people who have drink or drug problems who don't turn up, don't get along with you everywhere as well, is that right?
There are still DNAs. I mean, you saw from the thing. What it does is, I think, interestingly, with the King's patients anyway, took it down to the almost the same as the general population. So we will still sometimes turn up, and people won't want to go.
Yeah.
What we can do though in those cases is we can ring ahead. So we can ring the hospital and say this person isn't going to come, rearrange the appointment. Quite often rearrange it for a better time. So people know themselves. So if you say to somebody, you're not making this early morning appointment, would it make a difference if it was later in the day? Or on the flip side, would it make it better if it was earlier in the day so you'd not had as much to drink? Then often you can actually rearrange it to a time where people can attend. But yeah, no, we definitely don't get 100%
that
would be magic.
And quickly, they go into some of the appointments with doctors, so sometimes a patient might decide, I don't want to.
So it's completely up to the person whether or not they want the peer to go in with them or whether they want the peer to wait outside. So I would say in the majority of cases the peer goes in with them, but definitely not.
No, in GP we see it from both ends. We see it really helpful.
Yeah.
You know, coming in and people sort of, really being able to speak because someone's there supporting. Equally, there are other times when you think, actually, I'm not getting a true story at all here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons they have so much training, they do 4 days advocacy training. So they do 4 days training just around advocacy and about what it means to be an advocate. And about that, you being there for the individual and to put their point of view.
Yeah.
The other thing about the people not attending, we do find sometimes that if they don't attend the first time, they're more likely to go the second time. We've got quite a few people who've said, I didn't go the first time, but then the second time, because you came back, I did go with you.
That kind of someone's bothered to come all the way here to knock on my door at 8 in the morning to try
again.
And get me up to go to an appointment again, and I tell them that I've really got to go, this guy's kind of not going away.
Okay, one final question or comment? Or?
I work for Together, which is a national provider of mental health charity, and I work around peer support. So obviously peer support around mental health, but we also look at multiple experiences that all kind of link in with mental health, and obviously from today and from a lot of conversations I have with people with homelessness and mental health go really quickly together. And you're talking about that be around access to mental health services or supporting people to access mental health services?
It would be mainly around people with lived experience of homelessness supporting homeless people to mental health services, because I'm aware there's a lot of very good mental health peer support stuff out there. But what we find a lot with the guys we're working with is that they don't see, even though someone's got that shared mental health experience, because they've not got the shared homelessness experience, that can sometimes be a bit of a barrier. So actually one of the things we'd be looking at is supporting people to access peer mental health services and that kind of support groups, because I think people are very worried about stigma, very worried about how they'll be. So we find that our guys don't use other support, like we've got a lot of people who are HIV positive, they don't use HIV support groups very well, because they don't, even though those people are those peers, are their peers because they have a similar condition, they see the fact that their homelessness is being kind of...
There's multiple levels of oppression and stigma, and I think a big part of peer support is around helping people manage that, because it's not a nice world for a lot of people to live in. So being able to sort of sweep around, somebody has wanted mental health peer support, but they may also have experiences around homelessness. They may want a peer supporter who has also had experiences of homelessness.
I think that we see that quite a lot. So we would see ourselves as working alongside other mental health peer support to do that kind of support. And I think the other thing we're interested in with the mental health stuff is the extent to which actually we should also be supporting to other well-being things. That it's not just about getting to a counsellor or getting... Actually, maybe we should be supporting people around other stuff which is good for their general well-being.
I think there's something about how mental health is spoken about as well, though, because when it's spoken about quite medically, like in terms of diagnosis and in terms of I guess, the illness model, for some people, yeah, that makes sense to people, but for a lot of people who have felt outside of the system and have bad experiences in the system, and I've experienced mental distress and used mental health services, but I've never been homeless, but from what people who have been, quite often the kind of the language around it isn't always appropriate for what people connect to, and I think
and it's often very kind of complex because people, there's a high incidence of complex trauma in childhood, then there's substance misuse, then there's so many interlinked things that it can actually be quite complex for people to even think about a diagnosis. It's just there's a lot of going in. Whereas physical health is obviously much easier. You know, I've got a huge, great big gaping sore on my leg.
Yeah.
Is there.
Yeah.
On that note, we should draw to a close. I mean, I think it's one of those seminars where pretty much there's outright agreement in the room. But I think certainly two takeaways for me. One was Alison's point about the need for it to really be meaningful. I think anyone who's a professional in any of these fields has seen tokenistic involvement and seeing what a disaster that can be. So I think that's just worth stressing. And then I think, I mean, just for at a policy point, being able to put money on it the way you have done in the second presentation, really, really important, because that's just so compelling. If it's not only the right thing to do and it saves money, then you know, that's got to be a compelling case. So my thanks to the speakers and my co-chair, and thank you to you, and enjoy the reception and the rest of the conference. Thank you very much.
I'm a trustee of the York Road Project, so we're, I don't know if you've heard of us, we're sort of local homelessness charity in Woking in Surrey. I mean, I don't know, I obviously...